That's quite a big promise. Hopefully I can fill those shoes. I guess, let's see, something that, where to start, really?
Well, usually we just start with, like, what are you working through? What are you thinking about? What keeps bugging you?
So, I mean, at the moment, I'm still kind of getting situated back in Perth. I was traveling for a bit. I did a residency as part of this this residency called Arts BioArctica, and it's kind of with this group called the Finnish BioArt Society. So they have a small little biological research lab up above the Arctic Circle in a small town in Finland called Kilpisjärvi. And so I was up there for a month kind of working on some new research. So it's this new project that I'm still working through. So it's very amorphous at the moment. And it kind of started based on a few questions and conversations I had with a friend of mine, Emily Parsons-Lorb, about like a year and a half, about a year and a half ago. We're just talking about potentially doing a project up in the Arctic. And she was doing her PhD research on air and the difficulties of representing air and how to make an archive of air. And I've been working with just ideas about translation and how to translate kind of different experiences. So we kind of talked about going up to the Arctic. And so unfortunately, she wasn't able to go because of funding, but I ended up still going up there. And so I spent a month in this small town kind of collecting air data. And so now I'm kind of processing that experience and trying to figure out how to translate some of the data that I collected up there into something to show. So yeah, that's kind of where I'm at the moment.
Wow. That would be a lot to process.
It's only been 4 weeks, so I'm still coming back. But the gist of kind of my time up there was spent mainly going out and hiking and trying to take different sensors with me and use those sensors to just record my movement through the space and record just some of the local temperatures. And the idea is to sort of try and connect abstract weather experiences into a more bodily experience. So that's like a starting point of a thesis or something.
And have you had any great insights or epiphanies along that path to that end?
I think it's coming along. I think while I was there, I was doing quite a lot of reading from Timothy Morton, who's he's a writer that talks about this idea of the hyper object. And so there are these objects that are distributed through space and time. And so thinking about sort of large scale weather phenomena as hyper objects and trying to represent a lot of data in a compressed amount of time. So the gist of it is, there's something that happens in the polar night up in the Arctic called Arctic haze, and it's this collection of weather pollutants. So it's mainly sulfur dioxide, black carbon, and I believe also nitrogen dioxide. And so it's pollutants from North America, Europe, Russia, China, and they end up collecting in the Arctic. And so these pollutants collect up there, and then at the onset of spring, when the light comes back, you get this really big spike in pollutants. So there's been weather stations that have been collecting this data for the past 30 to 40 years, and so there's like a big database on all this stuff. So I grabbed some data from that database and have been trying to figure out how to compress all this into maybe a short experience. So looking at kind of creating a wearable installation that affects your body, that's translating this Arctic haze weather data into some sort of personal felt experience that's trying to grasp just larger ideas and really kind of smaller ideas at the same time.
Strikes me as something that some subcultures already do really effectively, which is like if you're speaking to somebody who builds computers, for example, and you can reel off certain numbers of processor speed or temperatures or heat sinks or something like that, and they'll have a visceral response to that very dry information, because they'll be able to instantly take what you've said and compare it to their memory of what it was when that number was a little bit smaller or a little bit higher. Or when people are standing around talking about the amount of horsepower in a vehicle that they're rebuilding or something like that, and the information is dry, but it directly is in comparison to something that they've already felt. I wonder if there's any insights in there.
Yeah, you know, like when you say that, so it's this funny thing, I think, because the majority of people that end up seeing Arctic haze are, a very small number of people, and often if scientists are doing studies on it, they're either going to be in a remote research station or they're going to be up in a plane flying over the sky. So it's kind of this really removed experience that I don't think many people have been privy to be honest. So I was kind of interested in coming up with different ways to sort of represent this almost the equivalent of like the Pacific trash heap, but in terms of air, and trying to like represent that on a bodily level. So I've been toying around with like bike tires and pumps and basically ways to create insulation that sort of wrap around your body and fill with air and inflate and deflate, causing some sort of constriction of your breath based on the actual timing, and just trying to relate somehow the personal breath that you have to these this larger weather phenomena of Arctic haze.
And that's something that you've built already, or that's something that you're thinking might be an angle to take?
I've got a few working prototypes. They're not much to look at right now, so I'm kind of fine-tuning that in order to actually present them. So that's kind of where I'm at the moment.
Um, is it a weird thing to consider weather as an object or as a hyper object? It's just going back to what you were talking about before. How do you do that?
Yeah, it feels like in some ways trying to reduce it to an object makes it, you lose some of the really prominent aspects of it. I think in some ways it being a process, I think in some ways trying to reduce it to an object is almost a political act more than a really coherent artistic strategy, if that makes sense.
No, that makes a lot of sense. So I wonder how those two things sit beside each other for you, in that you're on an artistic endeavor to be affected by and then represent something in a way that people can feel, but the way that you're engaging with the thing that you're representing is, like you said, inherently quite a political act. And I wonder how those things are treating each other.
to be quite honest, I think at the moment I'm more interested in, I guess like the distillation of this really large process into just a really momentary experience. I think in terms of reducing it, I'm quite happy with that, just because it is this, in some ways there's quite a didactic element to this, is like explaining that there's quite a lot of heavy pollutants going on, and that seems to be one of my focuses at the moment, is just having an installation that's effective, that relates back to these issues of pollution. So in that respect, I think some of the politics overrides pure aesthetic exploration in some ways.
That's a good point. It makes me think about whether the only way to experience a hyper object is through virtual reality, if in the way that you experience objects through reality, then hyper objects are best experienced through virtual reality, because our nervous system is set up to experience an object rather than a hyper object, for example.
So you're saying you'd have to have some sort of I guess that's a fair point. I think in some sort of alternative installation or virtual reality, I think that's quite an interesting way to go about it.
Yeah, it seems like, so I just finished reading a book that's a trilogy called, starts with Ancillary. So the first one is Ancillary Mercy, the next one's Ancillary Justice, I think. But what goes on a lot in there is they're living in this reality where a lot of people have augmentations to their senses, to their nervous systems. So especially captains of ships, for example, when something happens to the ship, the captain feels it as if it's happening to their body. And it sounds a little bit like that's kind of what you're talking about, is that there's weather stations that are recording this kind of information, but it's not going to hit us or affect us if this information is read as statistics, only as if we get to try on the central nervous system that is the weather stations
and we are being hit by the pollutants. And it's almost like you're doing the job of a translator from a hyper... If we're talking about hyper objects, then we're also talking about a hyper nervous system or a hyper sensorial system. Am I completely on the wrong track and there's other things that you're thinking about that I'm missing?
No, I think, do you know, what's his name? Neil Harbison. He's kind of, he deals a little bit with augmentation, and sensory manipulation. He, a little while back, is, I think he's the first man to be recognized by a government as a cyborg. So I forget exactly where he's based, but he has a passport photo with him and some sort of augmented device that's implanted into his head.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's this guy that was born colorblind.
Mm-hmm.
And just sees the whole world in monochrome. And so he ended up getting this sensor that sees color and then sends a small vibration to a bone behind his ear. And so he, according to him, kind of feels color.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense, or some translation of the light that's kind of passing through this sensor.
Yeah.
And so he's really interested in synesthesia and sort of augmentation. But in terms of like your question about whether you need like some sort of hyper,
synesthesia. Network.
Yeah.
Or maybe
in terms of like, hello.
Yeah, maybe that's like the first step, but then you're much further along and you've got other ideas about how to get people to feel these hyper objects without going directly to things like augmentations of senses, sensory nervous systems and stuff.
I'm not really interested in this is more of kind of an augmentation that's removable. But I think in some respects it's similar because at this point I believe Neil Harbison can hook up his augmented sensor and to the internet, so he's actually getting information from multiple different places at once. And so, I believe the basic definition of a hyper object is that it's something that's very large scale that's distributed over space and time. So, like the primary examples are styrofoam is one because it exists for thousands and thousands of years. And also like the collection of nuclear waste is another, but I think like climate change is considered another, but I think in like Harbison's case, like he's getting light data from multiple different locations around the world. So in some respects, he's got some sort of a hyper object that's not really identifiable yet, if that makes sense. I guess in my case, I'm not interested in something that's really implantable. It's more kind of working through how to represent a very specific climate condition and have that create maybe some sort of visceral or anxious experience. So the way I've got this sort of working at the moment is these series of tubes wrap around your chest and constrict every time the frequency of Arctic haze increases. So I've got weather data that goes back to the 70s. And you can see that there's an annual spike around springtime. So essentially I'm compressing all that into the span of maybe 10 to 15 minutes, you get these frequent spikes that would within the data that would sort of constrict your breath with this series of pneumatic tubes. So yeah, I guess more looking at strategies for representing this thing that's removable and kind of impressing some sort of very in some ways constricting tactile experience.
How do you work out what is a good time frame for the body to experience something? Say, like the 15-minute intervals that you were talking about that are actually representing yearly phenomena. I wonder, is that like a planetary to human? Is that like dog years, human years?
I think it's probably based more on attention span, to be really honest.
Yeah.
It's not something that you can exist for maybe like it's not a durational thing where it would be like an hour and a half. I think the ability to compress all this information and to run it back almost like a VCR recorder running through a video in a matter of like an hour-long video in 30 seconds or something like that, you get this sort of racing feeling where a lot of the information is kind of skipped over, but you kind of see the spikes and the valleys and the troughs essentially.
Can you give me a little bit of insight into why this is important? Why this information is important or why this phenomena is important, but why you think it's important to put your efforts into making us feel that information and that phenomena?
I guess it's, I don't know, I was listening to a podcast the other day called Long Form, and there's just this discussion in it where these two journalists were talking about the difficulty of making people care about something as large as climate change. And they talked about it almost being like this holy grail of journalism is like to make a story that people read and care and that moves them so much to act. And I guess in some ways I'm in no ways trying to go after a large topic like that. But I think there is something similar there in the sense that we get so much information about large climate issues that it ends up being just noise and we can filter it out quite easily. So it's really just the thought experiment into a different approach to sort of communicating this information.
Cool. That's cool.
I don't know if that it sort of explains it. I feel in some ways because it's still unfinished. It's like you've sort of caught me midway. There may be a lot that's to come in the future. I don't know. It'd be interesting to have a follow up after. There's a little more, concrete. A few more concrete things. Hopefully that gives you an idea of where I'm going with this stuff.
Yeah. Do you have, I guess that thought that it's not quite ready and finished and concrete is reflective upon other things that you've done, which during them were also not quite ready and finished and concrete, but now after the fact they are. I wonder if it would give us some insight if you just wanted to touch on something else that you have been in this same place with, a different project or a different investigation, where you remember not knowing and then now you're on the other side and you feel like you know.
I think there's like one sort of project that I was working on last year with a PhD student at Symbiotica, which is a research lab in Perth that deals with like art science crossovers, and I talked with one of the PhD students named Audrey Bester, who she did her PhD research on the visual perception of lungfish, and it's kind of this funny project in a good sense, where the lungfish is the evolutionary link between land and sea. So it has this strange and complex eye system. So she was doing these experiments testing what the retina could see, and she ended up having experiments where she was testing the visual perception on blind lungfish. So there's like this inherent irony there. And she had all this data, and we sort of talked about how to represent this. So we ended up coming up with this small little headset that you wear, and she translated the data into sound, and then we translated the data into small little pulses of red light. And at the time, it seemed really kind of amorphous, and we were trying to figure out why and what was interesting. And so we made this small little headset that you put on, and you can hear essentially the visual perception, or like the electric impulses from the visual perception of lungfish in your ears, and then you see sort of flashing that's related to the electrical impulses of lungfish retinas, and they slightly get out of time and out of sequence. And so, that was more a starting place to talk about how almost possible to fully understand how this strange fish would see. And, as much as we were using tools of hardcore science to actually cognitively understand it, there was no perceptual way to really engage with it beyond, really kind of simple flashing lights and pulsing sounds. So it was an interesting project. Ultimately, it's kind of this exploration of like the futility of trying to understand another animal's visual experience. So in the beginning, it was kind of this exploratory thing that kind of solidified at the end. So, that's probably one example of a project from last year that kind of has the same feelings at the moment, that sort of unsure question of what it will be, but it's kind of exciting in the same way.
Yeah, it's a weird thing to be reminded that there is no way for you to experience, to decenter yourself from experience, and that like the way that we talk about that in relationship to other people is to speak about empathy or to speak about compassion, because it's understood, even though it's often forgotten, that there's no way for you to actually understand without experience, and then even then your experience is going to be different because of so many other things, and so you just have to have compassion. And it sounds like a little bit you're talking about a scientific version of compassion to try and experience the shared world, but from a place that is not, you know, an average of a meter and a half high and slightly hair covered, but not really, and like warm blooded, like to try. It sounds like a lot of the science that you're undertaking is a statistically underpinned push towards compassion beyond just other people.
Yeah. I mean, that's an interesting way to think about it. You know, I hadn't really thought about it in terms of that, but yeah, that might be an interesting framing. A thinker named Jacob von Oxgall, and he came up with this idea of the Umwelt, and it's essentially like you describe it as perceptual bubbles. And so we all live in these perceptual bubbles that limit how we can sort of experience the world. And, you know, he describes, he was a biologist, so he also focused on human animals. And he describes a tick, and he talks about how, you know, its perceptual bubble is limited by sort of the physiology that it has, the fact that, you know, it can smell butyric acid and feel temperature. Those are like the two main constraints of how it experiences the world. So it'll like climb up to a tree, and when it smells butyric acid, it falls and hopefully lands on a warm surface, and that surface is hopefully like a mammal that it can then get nutrition from. And so like it's this tiny, tiny umwelt or perceptual bubble. Meanwhile, we might have more sensory perceptions. So we would have like a larger bubble, but we still don't have access whatsoever to like the way to experience the world in a radically different way. So I think if anything, some of these projects are ultimately failed attempts to look at the limits of a perceptual bubble or an umwelt, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that sounds very cool and very exciting and a little bit humbling to be reminded, to be working towards trying to see a bit beyond your perceptual bubble, to know that you are operating from within a perceptual bubble.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of this thing just being always constrained in some ways, I guess. But yeah, so it's kind of an interesting area to work in, because ultimately there's only so far that you can go with it. So, yeah.
Excellent. I usually just have one question to wrap up with, which is, what is your biggest hope for all of these efforts?
No, I guess now, because you can't remember the stage, I guess my hope would be that it comes to some concrete form, as simple as that, I guess.
It's nice, it's concise, it's simple. You're just trying to work something out, and so you hope that you work it out.
That's enough for me at the moment. But yeah, so.
Awesome.